This is John Lamacchia of Candiria. You're listening to my chapter of As the Story Grows.
Perfect.
I said it like an answer. like I was on the what is that show? I forget.
Jeopardy?
It, Jeopardy.
Yeah, when you read it, right.
As the Story Grows for 200.
What would you say you do here?
Have a good time all the time.
Who's got it better than us?
Nobody!
What in God's holy name are you blathering about?
Well, I'll tell you what I'm blathering about. I've got information, man.
I want you to be realistic.
What do you love about music?
Man being realistic.
As the story grows.
Welcome back to the next chapter of As the Story Grows. My name's Trav. Super happy to present John Lamacchia from the band Candiria this week. I met John, oh my goodness, I think 17 years ago. We haven't really been in touch, but vaguely remember each other. Met him way back in CC's in Moosic, Pennsylvania. Used to go see a lot of hardcore shows up there. A lot of bands say, we incorporate a lot of different musical styles. Nope. After you listen to Candiria, you can't say that. They got everything in here. And we're going to cover that with John. I've been rocking a Candiria hoodie since, oh my God, I've had that hoodie for 15 years. I have it on all the time. Love these guys. Anyway, enough about that. How y'all doing? I hope you're having a better month than I am. July's been a hell of a month. It's hot out there. Let's see what else has been going on. I went to see Hey Mercedes on their 15th anniversary mini get back together tour, I guess. They're celebrating Every Night Fireworks. Fantastic album, fantastic show. Got to meet the guys. And I got something coming down the pike with Bob Nana that I think y'all might be interested in. It's almost there. Just a couple more twists of a few more knobs, but it's coming. My Patreon subscribers know what I'm talking about. That's a nice segue, Trav. Thanks, Trav. Speaking of Patreon, got a new little bundle of joy named Frank MVP Santarelli. All you Music Bandcamp Gift Club people know who Frank Santarelli is because he's more than likely bought you an album. He's the most generous dude you'll ever meet. He seems hilarious. He's brazenly proud of the fact that, like, his jam is power metal. Dude rocks a Man of War hat. He's fantastic. He's an awesome dude. Never got a chance to meet him yet, but that's going to change someday, isn't it, Frank? We're going to talk. We're going to have a beer. So I want to thank Frank, and y'all know how Patreon works at this point. Just climbing, just a slow burn and a slow build. I am more than happy. But I appreciate the help, Frank, and everybody else who's pitching in. Hey, I got to read you something. So coming out of this, you're listening to Candiria's song Mathematics. And at the end of the song, you're going to hear bagpipes. And I know the dude who played the bagpipes. He's a good friend of mine. I've known this guy a long time. His name's Kevin Greenland. He played bagpipes at my wedding, actually. He's a beautiful soul. And he and I got into Candiria pretty early on. I don't remember who got who into them. I think I got him into them, but I can't remember. That's how long ago it was. He got to play bagpipes on this song. So I just texted him this week, and I said, hey, man, I'm going to be talking to Bebop Do you remember anything about your experience at the studio or any other stories? And here's what he sent. And I read this to John Bebop, and he said, you know what? That's really cool, man. I want people to hear that. So I'm going to read it to you now. This is like a tiny little ditty. These are like liner notes that that Kevin had to say. He says, at the time, my lip and mouth muscles were not strong enough to play for long periods without getting fatigued. So as a precaution, I drilled out the center of a baby pacifier and then attached it to the end of the blowpipe of my bagpipes to use it as a crutch in case my lips gave out. Playing my parts with the baby pacifier on the bagpipes kept everybody pretty amused. Ken, that's Ken Schalk, the drummer and kind of mastermind of the song. Ken wanted me to improvise my part for the song. His instructions for the take that made it onto the album were to play an ascending and then descending scale, but he wanted me to play it, quote, like life, end quote. He explained life to me as a ladder that you climb. You climb a few rungs up and then get knocked down a rung. Climb a few more rungs, get knocked down again. It's a struggle. So what is on the album is my attempt at improvising a scale that sounds like struggling to climb a ladder of life. John wanted everybody to hear that, so I read it to you. So without further ado, let's throw this over to John LaMacchia of Candiria.
That's fine with me. I don't care. Keep it lighthearted.
Yeah, that's how I do. John, cool. Super nice of you to take the time to talk, man. I appreciate it very much.
No problem, man. Thank you for having interest.
I do have interest. It goes back pretty far. It goes back to I first heard Candiria on it. Remember the mag Chord?
Yes.
You guys were on a Chord comp.
Yep.
And it was Suffer. And I blew out my speakers in two different cars to that
wow,
sound.
Wow. Awesome.
So it goes back pretty far. That was beyond reasonable doubt. That should have been right around when you joined the band, right?
Yes. I joined the band right when they were finishing recording the record.
Okay.
Yeah, it was pretty much like they were finishing the record, and that's when Chris Puma decided he did not want to play in the band anymore. He felt his passion for music was more about learning technique and learning how to play music and not performing it so much. And that was his sort of reason for not wanting to be, whereas opposed to the rest of the band, they wanted to be in a band, they wanted to tour, they wanted to go see the world. He wanted to learn about music, which, okay. I really admired about him, you know, being so sort of, having that foresight, being like, you know what, I can see what this is going to turn into. It's going to be turning into me being on the road a lot and I'm just going to be playing the same material all the time,
right,
as opposed to me learning technique and me learning theory and learning more about what I want to do, which is what he loved to play the guitar. You know,
I can dig that. I understand that.
Yeah, sure.
Before we go any further,
sure.
I hear your microphone dragging in a beard or a shirt or something like that.
Oh, you know what? It's my freaking beard. All right, I'll hold it. How's that?
Can you just go shave real quick? I think I'll leave that shave joke in there. I think that's pretty good.
All right. Yeah. Do it up. Do it up.
I've been saying that for a long time, how I'm not saying anybody who's in a band is a rock star, but you can't be a rock star in your basement if you're just playing, but you can be a musician down there.
Sure. Oh, absolutely.
And you can woodshed and practice and work. And
yeah.
And there is something to be said for, well, you're just doing it because you want the attention or the girls or the free beer or whatever. It's like, well, no, there's something to be said for like that guitarist that has to have the perfect sterile vacuum environment to play in.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, throw them up on a stage at a club that doesn't have that great a sound, and somebody kicked an amp over and that kind of thing, and see if he can handle himself in that situation.
Right.
I think there's growth. I think you should acknowledge the growth there too.
Oh, absolutely, man. I mean, there's all different ways to, you know, to go about being a musician,
yeah,
or being an artist, you know, and, you know, learning technique and learning it as a trade, mm-hmm. so to speak, and being a session musician, being a recording artist, learning about film score. I mean, you know, there's just so many different ways you can go about it. And to be honest with you, me personally, I would love to do more of the other things that I never had a chance really to do. I have dabbled in scoring, some short films, and I've written music for dance performances for Hunter College and students. And, I've done all kinds of really out there stuff and really like different like things for from what I'm known for. You know, like playing in bands and making records and you know, being like a dude in rock bands, you know? So, I really do enjoy that stuff. I really do enjoy all of the sort of the stuff that's sort of on the darker side or the darker side of the moon, so to speak, you know?
Right.
And yeah, I love exploring all different sort of ways to make music and to apply it to other aspects of the things that I love.
Let's talk about that a minute. I don't think anybody's ever brought that up before. What is it like to did you say you scored or you wrote music for a dance piece for Hunter College?
Yes.
How does that even work?
Well, it's
like really, from day one, did they call you or did you offer?
Well, no, it's didn't really have anything to do with the school like reaching out to me. It was a matter of I was actually dating a student.
Okay.
And the student was a dancer, and there was at the end of the year, the seniors do like, you know, they do this big show and they all put on, you know, performance for school. And it's, you mm-hmm. know, it's a pretty amazing event actually. And, so I got to put a piece in the show and work with a dance group and, you know, and we got to really, you know, just create sort of, but it's really interesting with working with people that choreograph, because dance comes first. And that was something that was really difficult for me to understand, was the movement comes first. Whereas mm-hmm. like me growing up in Brooklyn and New York, when it, you know, dancing, you dance to music. And then when it came to writing for a choreographed piece of a movement, you can't write music to that. You know, I mean, you can, but you really, it's just way more fluid. It's way more, it's way looser. And the music is just it's really odd. It becomes a very abstract combination of sound and performance and like dance performance. But it was a really difficult sort of learning curve for me to really wrap my head around the idea of the movement comes first. Mm-hmm. And then, like, because I couldn't write a beat. I couldn't just be a straightforward beat because the movement didn't move. It wasn't like they were doing these, like, African dance moves or okay, or stuff right. that was related to actual rhythm. It was like modern dance, and it was all like, you know, it was really just kind of like out there, very deep stuff, and nothing rhythmic, nothing that was mechanical, and it was very fluid. So the music had to be fluid, but it was really interesting, a really interesting learning experience for me, and I really enjoyed it.
I've never put a moment of thought into that before. Like while you were talking, the first thing I thought of was the music video for Thriller.
Oh.
With that constant.
yeah, totally.
And they wrote every single little pop and lock dance move around the bass line, around the music that Michael Jackson already made.
Right.
So the dances were plugged into that. I've never thought of the reverse. That's kind of blowing my mind. I wouldn't even know how to go about it.
Right. When you think about it, you're like, holy cow, how the hell do you apply music to people doing just odd movements? And then, like, say, you know, there's one person doing this one movement and then someone else is doing something completely different. And it's a really fun and interesting experience.
So how do you do it? You just sat there with a guitar and a keyboard and just started pushing notes or what?
Yeah, it really became more about creating atmosphere, creating almost like creating mood, creating reacting to certain moments in a dance piece, trying to find sort of the audio representation of that movement in that moment, and then moving on, and then like finding another way to do that. It was really interesting. I mean, that was, we're going back to like almost 20 years ago when I worked on the piece I'm actually speaking about right now. But
okay.
I did continue to work with to do some music for some dance performance, but it was mostly improvised. So so a lot of that was just really just like, we were all just like, anything went, you know, and it's like really like free formed and like kind of fun and laid back, and everybody's just having a good time, and like you're not even thinking a second about like what just happened. You're just like on to the next thing. How do I keep this mood going? How do I keep the feel going? How do I keep the dancers inspired, you know?
Did you offer your like you said you were dating someone there, did you offer your services up? That's kind of a ballsy move.
Well, she
tap him on the shoulder, be like, hey man, can I write music for this?
No, she was a major fan of a lot of the music we shared. That was one of the things we shared, like, you know, we were dating and we just shared like our love for music. She was into some really cool music like Swans and, you know, 16 Horsepower and really cool stuff that I was at the time. I wasn't remotely into. I was way more into like prog at the time and metal. And she just like kind of opened up my mind and my sort of my thinking. Like, it just, I was like, wait a minute, she's playing me this music and it's so incredible. I remember this moment, we were just sitting in her room and we were listening to Helpless Child by Swans on Soundtracks for the Blind. It's like one of my favorite albums of all time. And there's this moment in the song where the band is just like, the guitar is just playing this one chord over and over steadily. It's just a downstroke.
They do that.
Brown, brown, brown. And it goes on for like 10 minutes. And it's just so, so powerful. And I realized, I was like, holy crap, man. Like, you can do so much more with so much less. That's the time, like I was learning something there. I really was, because, you know, I was so involved in learning about being in Candiria at the time. I was so sort of like just experiencing that, like learning about, you know, time signatures, which I was already knew, you know, a good deal about. But then joining Candiria was like, dude, you know, You know, 7/8's one thing. Try 7/8 a bar of friggin' four, then 2 bars of 9, And, you know, then it turns around, but it starts in the back and goes, you know.
I think if you ever split Ken Schalk's head open, just numbers and equations would fall out. He's a robot.
Yep. He is. And that was really the thing. Like me and Ken did explore a lot of music before I was actually in the band. I think the reason I wound up in the band was mainly because of Ken. I knew the guys in the band. We were all friends. We all had like this mutual respect for our bands. Like I was in a band before Candiria called Dead Air with Mike, and we rehearsed in the same building. We played shows together. Yeah, we played shows together. We were not Dead Air and Candiria were like two completely opposite ends of the spectrum musically, mm-hmm. But we just loved each other's bands, so we would play shows together. And and then I started jamming with Ken. We had a project. Well, he had a project. Oh man, why can't I think of the damn name of it right now? Intrigue. That was the name of it. It was called Intrigue. Wow. And it was Ken on keys and synth. And our friend Joe Bacardi played drums, and that's all it was. And it was just this ambient, out there, really weird, great, amazing shit. And I sat in on a session, listened, and I was like, I got to jam with these guys. And I asked Ken, I was like, can I sit in on a session? Can I jam with you guys? And he's like, yeah, man, you can jam, but just remember, man, this ain't like no metal thing. You're gonna just like step in and start soloing. I'm like, I know, dude. I get it. You know,
just kick the door open. hey, whoa.
So, but then we jammed, and it was really, really cool. And it was really like one of the first times I ever was able to sort of jam in an open, improvised sort of setting like that. And then it just kind of developed from there. And all of this stuff was happening at the same time. I was dating this girl that was listening to all this really different, great, incredible music that was so inspiring. Mm-hmm. And I was learning about dance, and I was learning about movement and different, you know, all kinds of cool shit that I would never even think to go see or experience. And then I was learning all of this stuff about jazz and Candiria and metal and like, you know, all these amazing bands. And then I'm jamming with Ken, and all of this great stuff was happening in this really short period of time in my life. And it's really like some really fond memories there. Yeah.
Wow. That's very cool.
Yeah, man.
And isn't it cool that Candiria is probably, one of the best examples of like everything mixed into a crock pot, like everything. Candiria was like, nobody sees the jazz break with the horns coming ever. It totally sideswipes you. First time I ever heard Candiria, I was laughing because I was just like, I was like, I feel like somehow like the DJ flipped that switch in between the two turntables and I'm listening to another album by accident somehow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then it just stops. And it comes back and you're like, the hell are these guys doing, man? And then you find out Ken also plays the horns, and now you're telling me he was involved in synths, and I didn't even know about Intrigue. But
yeah, I mean, Ken is such a prolific writer. Right. I mean, and you know, I mean, at this point, I don't know if you know this, but Ken is not in the band anymore.
I did know that.
Okay, yeah. But he is in LA. He's still a very highly active musician. Mm-hmm. But you know, he has a family now, and mm-hmm. It's impossible for him to be as prolific a songwriter and recording artist as he used to be in the late 90s into the mid 2000s. Mm-hmm. It's just simply not possible for him anymore.
Sure.
But I will say this. I can almost guarantee you Ken has, it's gotta be at least 500 songs recorded. I'm not exaggerating.
No, I believe you.
I'm not exaggerating. I swear to you, he has to have at least 500. And I'm also thinking it's possible that it's maybe closer to 1,000. But I'm going to say 500 just so I'm not like one day speak to Ken and he's like, dude, what are you crazy? Like 1,000 songs, what are you nuts? I'm going to keep it on the low side. And 500 songs, I swear to you, he has to have at least that many songs recorded just from sitting at home, sitting in his bed. I mean, Ken really he was obsessed with recording music and everything. He just would record like entire albums of just songs inspired by guitar, and he would play all the instruments because he plays guitar, he plays bass, he plays flute, he plays trumpet, he plays drums, he plays synth, he plays Rhodes and keys and all that stuff, and all kinds of percussion. Obviously, some of the instruments he plays better than others,
sure.
But from a writing standpoint, Ken was just, to me, he was such just a brilliant songwriter. And he could give him any instrument and he's going to just make something amazing with it, you know? And that was, it was a really inspiring thing because I lived two doors down from Ken when I joined Candiria. It was really interesting. We basically all lived in the same neighborhood. We all lived, me, Ken and Eric lived on the same block. We lived two doors down from Ken and I actually built a little recording studio based on the exact recording studio he had built. So he had this Tascam 8-track and this little setup, and I would go to his house and I would record, and I didn't own any recording gear at the time. And then I came into some money, like a little bit of money, not a lot, but like, you know, a couple of grand. And I was like, Ken, I want to buy a recording setup and I want to buy exactly what you have. Mm. And he went with me. We picked up another Tascam 488. There's a couple of microphones. He came to my house. We set it up. He taught me how to use everything. I bought a little preamp, a little effects processor, and I just started recording too. And I would bring him in my recordings and he would help me understand how to EQ things better and fine tune things and record better and do things this way. Ken was really my mentor basically for a long period of time. I considered Ken my teacher. He taught me how to record music. He taught me about graphic design. He taught me how to design t-shirts and design, use Photoshop. And he was just so happy to see someone so excited about learning that he was just psyched about it. And he wasn't proud about it. He didn't treat you like, he never, you know, spoke down to you or talked down to you. He was just like really happy. You were so passionate. Mm-hmm. And I'll be really forever grateful to that dude for teaching me stuff. But, you know, in my opinion, you had to be an idiot not to be a sponge and just be like, this guy was like, this is what he did with his teenage years. He did not hang out. He sat at home and he learned how to be an incredible musician and an incredible artist. And I'd be crazy not to just learn from him. And sure. I did.
Of course not.
Yeah. Yeah, man. And then, you know, Ken and I are still friends. We still collaborate on stuff. We still work on Candiria stuff. And yeah, man, still amazing to have that dude in my life as much as I can.
You still work on Candiria stuff with him? He's not in the band and he's in LA?
Well, he's definitely always going to be a part of this band in some way, okay. Shape, or form. And he's performed on the album, but he cannot commit to performing live. He couldn't commit fully to the full recording, you know, he couldn't commit to the full recording sort of demands that we had. I mean, we wanted to make a full length record. He couldn't come out here for, it took months, you know, he's got kids, you know, right. So.
Yeah, I know,
yeah, exactly. But I mean, still like things couldn't be better the way they are now. I mean, he's just, you know, Ken, we have his blessing and he helped us find the right person for the band, the right drummer for the band. And, you know, it's just, we're in a great place right now. The band sounds amazing. We're playing shows. The album is incredible. We couldn't be happier. And things are just really good. We're in a really good place.
Didn't look that way in 2002, huh?
No, it did not.
I know you talked about the accident before multiple times. We don't have to go super into that or anything, but
no, it's fine. It's fine.
Okay, but yeah, Candiria got thwacked out on the road. A tractor trailer came up through their through their equipment trailer and rear-ended their van through the trailer. Correct?
Yeah, pretty much. It hit the trailer. The guy fell asleep behind the wheel. We were in the right lane. We were doing about 45 in the right lane, which was very dangerous. But we were having carburetor trouble. And we were not going as fast as we could have been going. I don't think it would have really made that much of a difference. But needless to say, we were in the right lane doing 45. This guy fell asleep behind the wheel. His foot was pinned to the gas. He was doing about 80, 85 miles an hour.
This is a tractor trailer, mind you. Which outweighs you by 30 times over, right?
Just insane. And the tractor trailer hit us, basically split the trailer in half long ways. We were, you know, sort of thrust ahead, and then we jackknifed and sort of got sucked back into the tractor trailer again and got hit again, and then we flipped several times, and I was ejected from the vehicle. My bass player was, Eric, my guitar player was, and Ken was. Four of us were ejected from the vehicle, and Carly remained, and the driver remained in the vehicle for the entire, which I don't know which was worse, honestly, you know? It was insane. You know, like, it's a miracle that no one was killed. It is a miracle.
My blood went cold when I heard that.
Yeah. I mean, it's a miracle that anyone survived that. We did. Everyone survived. It's amazing, man. No one is a paraplegic. You know what I mean? It's a miracle to me. That is like one of the most miraculous things that I ever went through in my life. We all got hurt very bad, but I mean, that the fact that I am here and I can walk and I can still play music, it's a miracle to me.
How badly were you? I mean, we're talking about huge, broad things here, and the podcast is about you, so we'll try to narrow it down.
Sure.
How badly were you hurt? What happened to you?
I was ejected from the vehicle, and I was found, I think, 30 feet away from the vehicle after it stopped, so I must have hit the pavement and rolled a whole bunch with it. I broke my arm, I broke my scapula, my collarbone in two places, my first rib. I suffered a global hematoma, which is pretty much, it bruised my brain. Pretty much. Sure.
You threw it 30 feet. You're going to do that.
Yeah. Sure. I mean, I think I went out head first of the window, and I think just hitting the pavement, I must have hit my head really hard. And it's really interesting because the one thing that stayed with me is I still have dizzy spells from it. I still get the same problem that I had. Something happened with my noggin. Mm-hmm. And I never was able to sort of get rid of that. And every now and again, I'll wake up and I'll just have a day where I just, the whole day, any quick movement, I get really dizzy. I get a dizzy.
Kind of vertigo, a little drunk, kind of.
Yeah, it's like something's is not right with my equilibrium after that. And hey, man, you know, it could be worse. But I broke a lot of bones and suffered a really, really bad head injury and two herniated discs in my neck, and then I had to have a surgery on my arm. It's really strange because after the accident, of course, from being, you know, from landing, hitting a highway and like rolling or whatever, I had all of these scars and cuts and open wounds. And on my arm, I had this open wound. And eventually when it healed, I always felt this weird sort of lump on my left arm.
Okay.
And, I was like, there's just something not right about this. So I went back to my doctor and I said, something's up with this. And he did an x-ray. And sure enough, there was a rock stuck inside of my arm from the accident.
Some men need two women. Some need alcohol. Everybody needs a little something, but Lord, I need it all to get my rocks off. with my rock soul. I'm getting my rock soul for the mountain and roll 'em on down the hill. Oh.
And he had to do like a surgery to go in there and fish this fucking stone out.
How'd they miss that?
I don't know, man. You know,
like,
I don't know.
Took my collarbone in two places. Did you say global hematoma?
Yeah, global hematoma.
Broke my scapula, yeah. Broke my arm, broke this. Missed a rock in my arm?
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't broken. My arm wasn't broken. That arm wasn't broken. My other arm was.
Okay.
And my it just got, somehow it got sucked into my arm. And it just went unnoticed with all the other injuries I had, I guess. And then, you know, a few weeks later when it healed up, I went back to the doctor and he looked at the x-ray and he said, look, man, I wish I still had the damn x-ray. He wouldn't let me take it. I wish I was able to keep it because it's really funny looking. You literally see, you know, you see the x-ray of an arm bone, which has the two bones.
Right.
And then right in the middle of the two bones, there's this like rock. And it's just really funny.
And he dug it out. But, he dug it out with no complications. It isn't like your bones grew around it or anything crazy like that.
No, he went in there and he dug it out and it was fine.
Okay, good.
Yeah, everything's fine. I still have a scar, but it's fine.
That's badass.
Yeah.
Getting my rocks off a mountain and roll 'em on down the hill.
That was scary. I remember you guys used to play with Dysphoria a lot. Remember them?
Yeah, I do. I remember those guys.
Yeah. I heard through the grapevine from that crowd from the greater Philadelphia Lansdale area. That was my stomping grounds with some of these shows. And
okay.
Yeah, I heard through the grapevine about the accident. They're done. Candiria is over. There's no way they'll ever get back on the road. You guys overcame a lot, and I know it's been documented. You guys did the album cover for What Doesn't Kill You was the Van, and it's like it's kind of tongue in cheek and it's kind of funny, but
mm-hmm.
It kind of depends on how the emotions catch you too. If you dig through that, if you just look at that album cover and really, I mean, you guys are posing with all your broken instruments, kind of not dead,
right?
That Van is blood ran cold, scary.
Yeah,
like, I can't believe people crawled out of that.
Yeah, I know.
And Carly and your driver were in it the whole time.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy, man. It really is. And you're right. I mean, it's a miracle. It really is a miracle. But you know, there are.
Are we going higher power with this conversation? Or
you know what? I don't know, man. I consider myself an agnostic, and that's in no way a reflection on the rest of the band members. We all have different beliefs.
Sure.
We're a very broad stroke of all different types of beliefs in this band, and that's a pretty amazing thing, actually.
Mm-hmm. That's neat, actually.
Yeah, it really is cool. But I consider myself an agnostic. I do believe in a higher power. I do believe in something that in something beyond this world. Some other connection to mm-hmm. some other power beyond any any human's ability. Well, maybe not any humans. My ability to perceive, to have any. You know what I mean?
Yep.
So maybe there was that. I don't believe that. I think when I say miracle, I think it's a miracle of the physical world. A miracle
More of a statistic anomaly.
Exactly. More of like this physical feat or this crazy coincidence of all of this violence. And somehow
miracle is a short way to say there's no friggin' way six people survive that and five of them make an album 2 years later.
Exactly.
Gotcha. Okay, we can leave it right there.
Sure.
Defend your brother!
Can you discuss? I want to combine two things that I heard about. You did an interview about spilocopa. Mm-hmm. Am I saying it right?
Yep, you are.
I don't even know what it means. What's spilocopa even mean?
It's apocalypse in reverse, basically. Oh, and
yeah, it is almost.
Almost. But you know, it's like, once again, I hate saying this, but smoking weed, it leads to certain things. And you know, sometimes you just have a moment with a word, and you just sit there and you're just looking at it, and you're like, oh, that'd be a cool name. And that's really how it started. Yeah. You know, the interesting thing is, the reason why it stuck with that project was that came along right before 9/11 happened. and
kind of prophetic.
Yeah, it was very, very prophetic. It was a very, really, like, I don't know, it was interesting because, you know, when you think about it, in my opinion, it was like, man, what a perfect title for a project that is developing in the middle of this chaos that's happening around me in this city, you know, in the middle of this time of fear and sort of, you know, uncertainty of what's going to happen next.
I,
you know,
I can't even pretend to know what it must've felt like to live where you did. I live Lehigh Valley. I'm near Allentown, Pennsylvania. Okay. Mm-hmm. The whole 9/11 thing was just, it was a horror movie. It wasn't real. It was so big. It wasn't mm-hmm. real. And then you talk to people from New York, like, it was real. It was happening right here. And
yeah,
like from somebody who doesn't live there and just saw it on CNN on a loop for 3 weeks straight, it just didn't resonate. It can't possibly be as bad as that. Right.
Well, you know what? I'll be honest with you, man, because there were two ways it was happening here in New York.
Okay.
Okay. It was happening for real. When you stepped outside and you smelled the smoke in the air, I lived across the water in Carroll Gardens, where a mile and a half from Manhattan there? It can't be more than that, like a straight line. Sure. to Manhattan Island from Carroll Gardens.
I don't know.
It is. It's about a mile and a half or so. Okay. Whatever it is.
It's right there. In other words, it's right over the water. It's
right over the water. Right over the water. And, I mean, you can hear the screams from the building. You can hear the horror that is happening there. You can hear it. You can hear it echoing, you know, throughout where you are, throughout the city. You're hearing this happen. Like, you're seeing it. You're hearing it. You're smelling it. It's happening to you. This cloud of smoke that was coming from the Twin Towers was coming right over us, right into Brooklyn, right over us, right down, traveling south toward Coney Island and Bay Ridge. And when all the dust from the fire came down, it all came down on the rooftops where we live. So we had to run inside. It looked like it was snowing out. I mean, there were some things that were happening that were so surreal and so unbelievably beautiful. If you just forgot that there was these buildings were burning, if you just looked out the window and that was all you saw, it looked like it was snowing out. But that was ash from the Twin Towers that was falling on the building.
Wow.
And the papers fell from the building. The papers were flying across. That's how close we were. There were papers, articles of there was a glove that fell on our roof. I mean, that's how close we were. It was caught up in the plume of smoke. These papers from the buildings were pouring all over where we lived. And there was papers all over Brooklyn in our neighborhood. And you picked
buildings. Those buildings exploded a mile and a half away over the water, mm-hmm. and it blew a glove onto your roof.
Dude, it blew that smoke and that stream of hot air was so powerful. It carried all of these things over the water, and it just started coming down on Brooklyn. And there were papers. I saved an entire bag of papers from the offices of the Twin Towers. I saved them. From that day, I gathered them all, and when I lived with Mike MacGyver from Candiria, uh-huh. and his wife and their family, and I just don't think they approved of keeping them, and they threw them away. But
okay.
I just don't think they wanted the memory there in their apartment. I moved out, and I should have taken him with me, and I do regret not doing that. But they felt, you know, I left the papers behind, and I don't know if this is true. I don't know if they just didn't know what they were and they threw them out, but I would imagine maybe they didn't want to have those memories there, and okay. maybe that's what it was. That's what, in my mind, that's what it is.
I respect both the person that wants to pick them up because they're blown away as to what's happening, and the person that wants them thrown in a dumpster because they sure. don't ever want to think. I can see both sides.
Of course, mm-hmm. Me too. And yeah, of course. But I mean, yeah, that's the thing. The other way it was happening in New York was on TV. You know, you had to watch what was happening because we didn't know what was happening unless you watched TV. All you knew was that two planes flew into the World Trade Center. You had your theories. But you didn't know that it was a terrorist attack until you watched TV, and until you watched news, mm-hmm. and you watched news, and you found out what the government's doing. And then we found out what happened with the Pentagon, and we found out about the other plane. You know, the news was happening. The really weird, strange thing was staring at the TV and looking out the window was the same image. You know what I mean? Like you're staring at the television set and you see in the Twin Towers burning. And then you look directly out the window where I lived at the time with Mike, and there were the towers. They were right there and they were burning. And the crazy thing is I shot two rolls of film that morning, two rolls of film before they fell. And me and Mike were standing on top of the roof. This is after the ashes fell and everything, the papers fell. We went back up there and we were talking. We're like, how are they going to put these fires out? How are they going to do it? Mm-hmm. What are they going to do? Is a helicopter going to come? Are they going to spray water like they do? No one ever thought for a second those buildings were coming down. Not for one second. And then they did. And it was just, it was insane to see it, to hear it, for that to happen. And that was it. I mean, after that happened, we were just, I mean, that was when the fear really set in. You know, I mean, that's when you were like, holy shit, this is World War III.
The skyline just changed.
Yeah. I mean, it was like, this is the beginning of another world war. That was how it felt at that moment.
Yeah.
And I mean, we're still at war. We're still fighting that war. And obviously now, I'm not going to get too deep into this, but I don't feel the same way about that war that I did when those buildings came down. But that's another interview.
I know where you're going with that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's another entire conversation. Maybe we'll do another one of these and we can talk about that.
I'll talk to you anytime you want. You can talk about it now. I don't give a
shit. No, well, I mean, let's stay on topic, man. I mean, I want right. to let you ask me about Spilacopa.
Yeah, what I was going to ask was shake that tangent off. Spilacopa, I heard an interview with somebody. You were talking about Demon John, kind of a, ooh, that's an ominous, kind of a dark name. Mm-hmm. And you said it had to deal with, like, you know, some personal demons and some addictions that I was dealing with.
Right.
And you read another article about the accident in 2002, mm-hmm. and it became, I broke half my body and had mm-hmm. had a bruised my brain, and it became like a prescription addiction conversation.
Right. Sure.
I assume we can tie the two together. You care to discuss any of that? Or
that's exactly what happened. The accident happened in 2002 with Candiria. Obviously I needed doctors and there were lawyers involved, and you were sent to these therapists and you had to deal with, go to see your orthodontist, who the hell does your bones? Is it an orthodontist? Did I have that right?
Orthodontist is the guy who does your braces.
Oh, Jesus.
Orthopedist?
Orthopedist. Thank you. Is that it? Bones, right?
I don't know. I think so. Yeah.
Well, the dude that does your bones.
The bone doctor.
The bone doctor. Like, you break your leg, you go see this guy.
Got it.
I think it's orthopedist. It may be. Anyways.
I'm going to look it up, and if it is, I'm totally going to edit that to make it look like I have some sort of a doctor and I know what I'm talking about.
If you leave it, I don't even care. I don't even give a crap.
Doesn't matter.
I went to see the dentist, and he looked at my leg. Okay?
I don't know if you have a shitty doctor or an awesome dentist.
I know, right? But anyway, that's really what happened. It just was, you know, after the accident, we were, you know, we all needed doctors. We all needed to see specialists. And we started going to do that. And you know, we were all in pain. I was in pain, and I had broken bones, and you know, how do you deal with that? They gave you a prescription for Vicodin, and you know, they're like, oh, you know, if you need more, come back next week or come back in 2 weeks. Come back when your prescription runs out. We'll get you a refill. Blah 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 blah. And this goes on for a couple of years, and you don't think anything of it. No one thinks anything of it. You know, you're just taking pills because you're in pain, and you need them, and you know, and you keep going, and you're not paying for them. Prescriptions, and you're getting them filled, and you're doing whatever you got to do. Mm-hmm. And you know, next thing you know, 3-4 years later, you're not taking them because you're in pain anymore. You're taking them because you're waking up and you're looking at, oh, I ate breakfast. It's time to take a pill. You know, and slowly,
the whole the Pavlovian response, kind of a thing.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It was about just maintaining. And the next thing you know, you're an addict. You just become an addict. It's really like it's going to happen if you continue on taking mm-hmm. that stuff for a couple of years. You're going to wind up with a problem. Mm-hmm. And it got really difficult for me when, you know, a few years later, you know, post traumatic stress syndrome from the accident, 9/11, all of these memories, all of these horrible things. My mom mm-hmm. got sick in 2006 and she passed away as more reason to just keep taking this shit. And then
right.
one thing after another. And then, oh my God, I'm a musician. My life doesn't, it's all, it's crazy. It's just one thing after another. And then mm-hmm. next thing you know, the doctor cuts you off. Now you're buying OxyContin on the fucking street and you're fucking pretty much, you know, I wasn't shooting anything, mm-hmm. but I was on my way to that. And it needed to stop. I needed to get help. And it was me. I just was like, all right, that's it. It's time to stop. My family had no idea. No one in my family really knew what was going on. Mm-hmm. And then I called my sister and I said, you know, I don't know if you know this, but I've been taking these pills for like years, like 9 years or whatever it was at the time. And she was like, oh my God, you know, and we started talking about it. And I said, I'm going to go to detox. And I did, and I started on my path of getting sober. But it was a very those years between, like I'd say 2003 to 2014.
Oh, it's that recent.
You know, yeah, I mean, I stopped with the pills and got on like a program with Suboxone and Bunavail. It's these two, in my opinion, they're miracle drugs. There I go with that word again. But they really are. I mean, you know, like it's pretty complicated stuff, but you're like, you go from one day being a complete addict and like, how can I stop? How do you even stop? How do you stop doing this? You can't. You'll get sick and you're going to be like, I can't do this. And you're going to go get drugs because you get so sick. It's such a horrible feeling.
Yeah.
But there's something called Suboxone now and doctors prescribe it. And it's like, the minute you start feeling sick, you take Suboxone or Subutex and it fills your opioid receptors so you don't feel any sickness and you can just start getting on with your life and you don't feel any urges, you know, and you don't, you know, as long as you stay on that program.
I've never heard of this before. So basically, like, pardon the ignorant terminology. It is coming from ignorance, not know-it-allness, but you're basically saying that this Suboxone mm-hmm. helps you with the dope sick. It doesn't do anything fill the void that Vicodin or Oxy was doing, but this drug just makes you not feel sick from not having the Vicodin. Did I say that right?
Well, it does two things.
Okay.
It's an opiate blocker.
Okay.
And it fills your opioid receptors.
Okay.
So it makes you your body thinks and you think that you're getting that drug, so you don't have that sickness anymore.
Okay,
you don't feel that. You don't get dope sick. You don't go through that. And the other thing is, it's an opiate blocker. So if you were on Suboxone and you took any type of painkiller, you would get sick. You would get sick, not dope sick, but you would get sick. Your body would reject it, and you would not get high from it. So, and I mean,
wow.
It really is.
I didn't know that technology existed.
Yeah, it does. It's a really amazing drug. And that's, I mean,
wow.
I hear people that are like taking like methadone and I'm like, what? Methadone? What? That's just another opiate. You know, like there's Suboxone now, there's Bunavail, there's drugs that you can take and you can get on this program And, you know, you wean yourself off of Suboxone. It's not something you're supposed to stay on for long periods of time. And when I say long periods of time, like, you know, I was on it for like 4 years because I had a serious problem. So I needed to take my time getting off of it. And, you know, and then I did. And, you know, when I released Demon John, pretty much Demon John was like a month before that I was completely sober. And it was like the way I got through it all. That album is all about all of these dark times and these dark songs and these, you know, I mean, Dusky Head is about, it's about my addiction. It's about, you know, about knowing, like seeing yourself just slipping away into this thing where it's like, look, man, you're going to eventually, you're going to push it too far, you know? And I mean, I guess that was my way of dealing with my addiction was writing about it. Dusky Head.
I'm going to hear that album with a whole different light now.
Well, cool, man. I hope that's a good thing. I hope that's that.
It's a very good thing.
You know, I'm really, I mean, there's other aspects of it. There's other songs on there about some other stuff, but they were all written in this time period of where I was in this state of mind and I was in this dark mm-hmm. place. So, but Demon John, actually, the actual title comes from, it's actually a Jeff Buckley song. And, I'm a huge Jeff Buckley fan. And, there's a Jeff Buckley album, and half the record is it's part like studio album that he was recording when he died, and the other part of it is all the demos that were going to be the rest of the demos that were going to be recorded. So that mm-hmm. record, half of it was made the same way I made Demon John. It was made with limited resources, a couple of microphones, an 8-track or a 4-track he had. I have a 16-track, and it was made the same way. It was like a lo-fi sort of limited resources, made at home type of recording. And that's how Demon John was made. So I thought it was a very appropriate title for more than one reason. And I really like that record a lot. I'm very proud of it. And I'm glad that it's being, like, I'm glad people that listen to the older Spilacopa stuff, like the stuff that Greg did and the EP, I'm glad that people that like that appreciate this as well. Because that was my fear. My fear was, this is so completely different that just people may not dig it. But it didn't matter to me. I had to put it out. You know, I had to do it. Mm-hmm. Loved or hated, I had to do it.
I love that story. I love the crawl back, man. That's so easy to flippantly say things like, you know, drug addict. You have to hear these stories. You have to hear the album connected to these stories. You have to know what the person went through.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's easy to say Vicodin pill popper, you know, hey whoa, let's pump the brakes a little bit, let's hear this guy's side of the story first, you know, like, you know, let he who hath no sin, right?
But did you say pump the brakes a bit?
Yes, I did.
I love that. I love pump the brakes.
Oh, you never heard that before?
I did. I have. And I have a really, the guy, Tom Tierney, one of the guys, well, the engineer that recorded the new Candiria record.
Uh-huh.
He says, pump the brakes a lot. And it's so funny because he's such an animated person. He's like, dude,
I am too.
Pump the brakes, man. He's like, got this really funny, like, hey, dude, like, pump the brakes, bro. He's so, oh my God, I love him so much. Gotta take it up to that.
That was level. A nice little segue there. That was a circle around talking about that. Let's talk about this new Candiria album. Tell me what's right, going
cool.
on.
Cool. Well, the album's recorded. It is mastered. The artwork yes. is delivered. Everything is delivered. We are now in the process of putting together a marketing plan for it with Metal Blade and our managers. And we're going to begin putting plans together for a tour or many tours. And we're going to get the record out there, make videos, play gigs, do all the things rock bands do. And
just start over.
Yeah, we're pretty excited. We've already been playing gigs and the shows have been amazing, and we are super psyched to be playing together again. Well, the core members and then to have these guys, Dan and Julio, these two amazing musicians that have come into the fold. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're just as insanely sort of meticulous and talented as a Ken or an Eric. You know, they are. They're just the same type. They're cut from the same cloth.
Eric left after the accident, right?
Eric left. Well, not directly after the accident. No one left directly after
due to the accident.
Yeah, due to the accident. He did. Eventually he did.
Okay, all right.
Ken left because he moved to another state. He moved to LA. He left in 2006 and was, you know, always connected to the band in some way, always writing and thinking about Candiria, but you know, could never fully be a member of this band again at that point. And although we did try this time to make it work with Ken, because, you know, he wanted to try to make it work. We wanted to try to make it work. We just couldn't. It was too demanding mm-hmm. financially. It was too demanding on him and his family, and we just couldn't do it. And, you know, having Ken's blessing and him knowing that, you know, we would love nothing more than for him to be a part of it, but it's just not possible. And having the, mm-hmm. the sort of the, you know, having the will to be like, okay, look, you know, and how do you lose a member like that and then carry on? How do you do that? You know, and then you start working with someone. You start working with Dan or a guy like Dan, and you put faith in him, and you just give him the time he needs to learn. And
I love this story. This is pointing towards the response of, oh, Candiria is back, but Ken quit? Psh, and they're going to just yeah. write him off as like, it's not the same band anymore. I mean, listen to what the man just said. This is tangible. This is where Candiria is at. This is what they can do right now. Mm-hmm, and yeah. and Ken's actually affiliated with it. It was that or no Candiria at all. So
right.
shut up and hear the new album, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I mean, Dan is, you know, I mean, he's the only person that we know that's capable of playing Ken's style. Mm-hmm. And also now developing his own style for Candiria. And we feel this is one of the strongest albums we've ever made. And we're completely psyched and confident, and I'm psyched about people being like, Ken's not in the band. It's like, okay, listen, you come to the show, you watch the band play, you're dissatisfied. I will buy your ticket. I'll give you your money back guarantee if you don't think we sound good, because
I love it.
I couldn't be happier with the way we sound right now. And that's not to say that I wasn't, you know, of course, when we were, I'm just happy that the band is at a point where we all agree, like, we found the right guy. This is Candiria. This is the band. This is what we sound like. We're functioning. And it's not like we're functioning and it's like this broken, like, version of what used to be. It's just this, like, you know, sort of, you know, like, reinvigorated sort of return to like what it's just great. Like we're so excited and it feels great. And the shows have been amazing. So, you know, I'm ready, man.
You guys are playing with the 20th anniversary for E-Town Concrete with All Out War.
Oh yes. Yes, we are. We will be doing that. We just played with Poison the Well. We played with Killswitch Engage. Right, yeah. We played with Killswitch. We played with Poison the Well. We played a sold out show at Gramercy Theater with them. It was unbelievable to share a stage with those guys. That band is
very cool.
So phenomenal, man. Holy crap. Yeah. And then, you know, and before that we played with Killswitch Engage, another incredible live band. Great guys. We love those dudes so much. And they were kind enough to ask us to open their show at Bowery Ballroom. They did like 6 sold out New York City shows in like 6 different venues. I mean, who the hell can do that these days? You know? But those guys, yeah, Killswitch can. Right. And, you know, love them or hate them, love the style of music or hate the style of music, you know, that band is incredible. And they get on stage and they do their thing, man. And we're happy to be friends with those dudes, you know, and we're looking forward to playing with E-Town. You know, I feel it's really interesting because when we got together, what we knew we didn't want to do was make people think this is a nostalgia thing. Because it's not. It's not. This isn't something where we're like, oh, let's go get back together and make a bunch of money. And like, you know, first of all, there is no make a bunch of money. You know, like it doesn't really work that way. It's not like we're like, I don't know, Cro-Mags or some huge, we're Candiria, you know? And yeah, right. We're well known, but it ain't going to be like, oh, let's get together and play a tour and make enough money to everybody doesn't have to work all year. That's not going to happen, you know? Sure. But we are like, it's really interesting because we've been doing these shows where we're sharing the stage with like the bands that we always used to like share the stage with. And we were kind of like a little like, hey man, maybe we're doing a little too much of this, but you know what? We're having a blast doing it.
Yeah. Who cares?
We're getting on stage and we're playing these incredible shows with our friends. That's basically what this is. And we couldn't, it feels so right. Like who cares, man? Right. You know, like we're getting on stage and we're playing these amazing shows with these bands that we have so much history with, and we're just having a blast, and that's what this is all about. And we're playing amazing shows. You know,
it's I was going to say the people who might be naysaying any of this are at home making comments on threads. They're not at the shows. People at the shows are doing backflips and losing their shit.
Yeah, man, they really are. Yeah, and the shows that we're doing on our own with newer bands and different bands, they're doing great as well. So things are really looking up. And soon the record will be out. It'll be out in October. And we'll be hitting the road. We'll be doing all kinds of stuff. And, you know, a year from then, I think we're really going to have our feet planted firmly back on the ground again. And we're going to be going to Europe, doing festivals, and I can just see like this first year is going to be getting sort of like getting back into that grind of like getting back on the road seriously. And then once we get our footing, it's going to be business as usual, you know, and we're just going to continue doing our thing.
How old are you?
Me? I'm 43. Yeah.
And 43 years old. You know how refreshing it is to hear a 43-year-old ready to roll up his sleeves after everything you've been through and be like, I can't wait to get back to the grind again. Like, I think a lot of people are cashing in on that nostalgic chip where it's kind of like, well, I'm not going to do this unless I have a bus, you know, that kind of, or at least that's the perspective from the ticket purchaser, you know what I mean? Sure. But I think it's really refreshing to hear a band say, no, I'm ready to go hit the road and, you know, and sleep on a floor and on occasion, you know, only get one hotel room because it's cheaper and somebody gets the floor, you know, like, sure. I mean, God bless you. I guess you just roll out of bed a little slower nowadays, but
well, let's just for the record, you said sleep on the floor. I said getting back to things. No, I'm just kidding. we probably will be, you know, it'll be like being on the road again. It'll be like it always was. And that's fine. I mean, Candiria was, you know, we did our punk rock thing back in the day. Then we got to a point where we could travel comfortably enough. We can travel in a van and get a hotel at night and share that hotel, 5-6 guys in a room. No big deal. We've all been doing it.
Sure.
You know, everybody gets to take a shower, wake up in the morning, get back in the van, and it's fun. It's fun, man. We have a blast on the road. And we're looking forward to it, you know, and whatever it is, it is. However we have to travel, we're going to do it. You know, it doesn't, going to sleep at night, it's not going to matter as much as waking up in the morning, getting in the van and getting to the club and playing the show.
Right.
That's, you know, the conditions of it, it's always changing, man, you know, because one minute you go into like one tour, you go to the UK and like you're traveling in this sort of really nice vehicle and you're on tour with Clutch and everything is awesome. Mm-hmm. And then the next time you go back, you're like, woohoo, that was great. It's going to be great again. Nope. You're sleeping on a dog mattress in the back of a truck and the driver is a meth addict and he was supposed to buy sleeping bags for everybody. But you open up the sleeping bag and put it on and you realize it's a junior sleeping bag and it only comes up to your waist. And he didn't get you a pillow. So
is this a true story?
This is a totally true story, man.
Your meth van driver bought you junior children's sleeping bags and no pillows.
No pillows. The bed that we slept on couldn't even sleep all of us. It could only sleep about three people. If you wanted to sleep on it, it was his dog's mattress that was in the garage. And it was rough, man. That was a rough tour. That was rough. And the shows were no good. They were booked poorly. We were playing in front of like 10 people a night. We had our merch arrived a week late. I mean, look, like I said, you know, sometimes you get on the road and everything is great. Sometimes you get on the road and just nothing works out exactly how you planned it. And that's just the way it is. And you just got to roll up your sleeves and you got to figure it out. You know?
Okay, wait. Yes, I hear everything you're saying, and it's all valid, but I'm stuck on something.
What?
The dude dragged a dog's mattress into a van for you to sleep on? Like, that's part of the arrangements from here, from New York. A guy over there was like, I got you. And then when you got there, his quote-unquote got you was a dog's mattress and sleeping bags that didn't fit.
Well, look. The guy had great intentions. He did.
Okay.
You know, he did. I mean, look, he got us a van. He put it all together. He built a loft over our gear. He just happened to put a dog mattress up there. You know, okay. And to him, it was okay. He was like this weird, crazy punk guy. And you know what? I still love that dude. This dude, Danny Boy. I love him to death. And okay. You know, I hope if he ever hears this, he's not too offended by me bringing this stuff up. And, no. You know, okay. I highly doubt I'll ever hear this. But anyway, if he did, big deal.
Me too.
Look, let's just say it was a rough tour. And then maybe it was a rough time for him, too. But there were a lot of – whatever, man. Touring can be rough. Touring can be rough sometimes.
No, I love these – at the time, you must have been like, oh, okay. But years later, you're on a podcast laughing about it.
Sure. I mean, dude, it's hysterical.
This is how we grow, John.
It's hysterical. I mean, come on. You can't write this stuff. If I have these images in my head of, you know, we're in East London in this dude's living room, six dudes, like everyone, there's nothing there. There's one, there's like everybody sleeping on a sneaker, you know, no blankets. It was just, we had no money. It was insane. And it was just rough, but it's a fond memory at this point, you know, fuck it. What doesn't kill you, man? That's
I think I have to name this episode What Doesn't Kill You. I have right. to, don't I?
Yeah. No, you do whatever you want. You do whatever you want.
What else do we have to cover, man? I feel like I kept you long enough. You've given me some great stuff.
I mean, I feel like we've come up to date and I feel like I'm comfortable if we stop here.
Kind of brought it full circle, huh?
I think we did.
John, thanks for your time, man. I appreciate it.
Anytime, man.
Oh, Danny boy, the pipes are calling from glen to glen and down the mountainside. Yeah.
We love you. Take care. Bye-bye.